The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. To the Eric Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Eric Metaxas Show. As you know, we have fascinating guests on this program, but the most important thing is that we pay for the program so that we can have the fascinating guests. So if you go to mypillow.com or mystore.com and use the code Eric, we'll be happy. You could also go to Nutramedics.com and use the code Eric, and we'll also be happy. Because we'd like to pay for the program. We think it's important to pay our bills. Listen, if you do that, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to have on a fabulous guest. Today, actually, specifically, I'm talking to Samuel Mitchum, who is the author of 40 books, the most recent of which is The Death of Hitler's War Machine. Samuel Mitchum, welcome to this program.
Thank you very much.
Listen, I love talking about history. I've written about history myself. I've not quite written 40 books. You've been doing this for a little while. When did you write your first book?
Oh, gosh. It was back in the late 70s. I actually have a distinction. I sold my first book twice. It came out in the early 80s, and I've been writing a book a year since then.
A book a year. People say that I'm prolific. I don't think I'm very prolific at all. You, sir, are prolific. Before
well, you write books with Bonhoeffer.
Well, I'm honored that you're aware of my books. Thank you very much. I'm excited to talk to you about your book, The Death of Hitler's War Machine, because I'm interested in that part of history. But before we get to that, it says, according to my notes, that before you started writing books, you were a U.S. Army helicopter pilot in Vietnam. What years were you flying choppers in Vietnam?
1972-73.
I have to say that not many people can say that they did that. That's an extraordinary thing. Have you written about that experience?
No, I won't. It still has the power to make me angry. I did one article involving the Vietnam War, and I did it for the Journal of Soviet Military Affairs. They asked me to review a book, and I couldn't resist working for the Soviets at least once, just once. And I got a free book out of the deal. But I don't even think about it much anymore.
You don't think about it. Are you willing to say why it makes you angry?
Because we could have won. We made a lot of mistakes. One of them was geographic. Fighting in South Vietnam and not North Vietnam. Then you, of course, go back to Clausewitz, the famous military philosopher, who said to introduce into war the principle of moderation is absurdity. Basically, what we said is we can, the North Vietnamese are bullies, and we can defeat them with one hand tied behind our back, which we proceeded to try to do. And frankly, failed. And there were a lot of good men wasted. The reverberations of that war echo today.
Unfortunately, that's true. Well, let's talk about a war that's slightly less controversial. It's called World War II. Your new book is called The Death of Hitler's War Machine. Tell us about that book, because most of us don't know enough about World War II history to think on this detailed level. You're writing about the Wehrmacht, the German army, and what happened to them in the last year of the war, roughly. Is that right?
Well, basically the last 5 months. From the end of the Battle of the Bulge to the fall of Berlin and the surrender of what was left of the Third Reich. And really, you're talking about two different wars. On the Western Front, the German soldier was convinced that they could not win. The end was near. They could see the fleets of Allied bombers flying on their way to bomb Germany. And they also knew that if they surrendered, there was a reasonably good chance that they would eventually get back home. The Russian front was characterized, however, by brutality. They were murdering civilians. They were mistreating prisoners.
You're talking about the Nazis. You're talking about the Nazis.
Go ahead.
When you say brutality, you're speaking on the part of the Nazis, not the part of the Soviets.
On the part of the Soviets.
On the part of the Soviets. So you're saying that, I think what you're implying then is that the Nazis fought differently because they realized if they lost on the Eastern Front, it was not going to go as well for them as it would on the Western Front.
Well, not just the Nazis, the Germans. A lot of them were not Nazis, but they were a German soldier, a typical Nazi. German soldier was not a member of the Nazi party.
Well, listen, thank you for clarifying that. My grandfather, to whom I dedicate my Bonhoeffer book, was one of those German soldiers. He was anti-Nazi, as far as I can tell. And one of my great uncles was captured by the Soviets at the end of the war, and he served 8 years in a Soviet prison camp. So this is personal history for me, and it's horrifying to think that someone as wicked as the Nazi powers under Hitler were fighting someone, in my estimation, at least equally wicked in the Soviets under Stalin.
I think you're right. We tend to think of Hitler as the great mass murderer of the 20th century. I don't think we should. I think we should think of Hitler, Stalin, and Mao Zedong as the three greatest murderers of the 20th century.
Yeah, I'm sorry to agree with you. Well, so tell us, what led you to write a book of all things about the last 5 months and the destruction of the Wehrmacht? What brought you to that subject for a book?
Well, it's kind of an interesting thing. I was visiting the National Archives, and I was looking for information on a completely different subject. And they let me back into the area they don't let the general public. And I came into a big bay-type office, and there was only one guy in it. He was going through a filing cabinet with his back to me. And I wanted to attract his attention without yelling, "Hey, you." So I yelled out, "Can't you find it?" And he was startled. And he said, "No, I can't." I said, "What are you looking for?" And he said, "Hitler's last will and testament." And I said, "Is that here?" He said, "Well, that's in the vault. Nobody gets to see that. I'm looking for a copy." And I asked him his name, and his name was Georg Wegner. How German can you get? And he knew who I was. He had several of my earlier books, and we got in a discussion, and it lasted about an hour. Six or eight guys came in. There was a whole circle of people. And Georg disappeared for a little bit, and he came back, and he had gone to the vault and checked out one of the four original copies of Adolf Hitler's last will and testament. High quality paper, leather bound. It was exquisite document. It was in the Führer type. You know, Hitler needed glasses, but he didn't want the German people to know that. So he had special typewriters made with like 24 count font. Very.
I've never heard this. Leave it to an historian to give us this kind of information. What year was you were in the National Archives when this happened?
I don't remember. It was back in the 80s.
Okay, so this is quite a while ago. All right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But what was really surreal about this was Georg said, "Close your eyes, put your nose against the paper, and smell it." And I did. And the odor of the Führer bunker, it actually permeated that paper. So just for a second, I had this sensation that I was in Hitler's bunker in 1945. You could smell the odor and the smoke and the dankness. exciting.
This is I'm so glad I asked this question. This is fascinating. So this was in the 80s that you stumbled upon this. It's a little bit hard to believe that Hitler's bunker was as far away from the 80s as we are from the 80s.
True. It is. Makes you feel old, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. But we're going to ignore that because this is show business. Folks, I am talking to Samuel Mitchum. The Death of Hitler's War Machine is the book. The Death of Hitler's War Machine. We'll be right back.
Hey there, folks. How many years have I been telling you about Relief Factor? What, like four? The truth is, I know there are millions of people, in fact, some say over 100 million people struggling with some kind of pain, maybe from exercise, just getting older. That could do it, getting older, which is why I am so impressed with Pete and Seth Talbot. They are on a mission. You rarely see this kind of focus and commitment. Seriously, they recently shared with me that they are doubling down and want to literally double their total number of happy customers in the next year, and I believe they'll do it. So here's the deal. If you're struggling with back, neck, shoulder, hip, or knee pain, even general muscle aches and pains, then I'm suggesting you order their 3-week quick start, still discounted to only $19.95, about a dollar a day to see if we can get you out of pain too. And then after that, less than the cost of a cup of coffee a day to stay out of pain. Go to relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com, or call 800-500-8384, relieffactor.com, 800-500-8384. I use it. It works. Check it out.
Hey there, folks. We're talking to the author, Samuel Mitchum. The book is The Death of Hitler's War Machine. Samuel, you've written so many books, and you're telling us that the provenance of this book goes back to the 80s. You happen to be in the National Archives at this point, researching another book, and you stumbled upon this figure, Georg Wegener, who puts a copy, a literal copy, of Hitler's last will and testament that the Allies had gotten somehow out of Berlin. You must have felt astonished to be in such close proximity to something like that.
Oh, I was. I lifted my head from the will, looked at Georg, and I said, wow. And he said, exactly. Because he said, it gives you the sensation you were there.
It really does. And I guess, where do we know where that last will and testament was found? Was it in the bunker? You're suggesting, obviously, that it was.
No, it was in the bunker at the time, but one of a major escaped the encirclement, took it home, and buried it. And the American History Department came looking for it. And once he was convinced that he wasn't going to get in trouble, he initially denied he had it. But when he was convinced he wasn't going to get arrested for possessing it, he turned it over, and it ended up in the National Archives.
So you're saying that this document and this happenstance moment in 40 years ago in the National Archives led to your interest in this in the last 5 months of the German army's existence?
That did. Also got a copy of Hitler's doctor's diary. He had a medical diary of Adolf Hitler, and you talk about the Führerbunker. It was picked up by a British officer who was allowed to visit the Soviet zone. He went into the bunker, sat down, saw a journal on the floor, picked it up, and it was Hitler's medical doctor journal.
What is the name of that doctor?
Theodor Morell.
Morell. I mentioned him in my Bonhoeffer book. He was sort of a famous quack that was Hitler's guy. Kind of amazing. Did he survive the war?
He did. He died in prison, but he did survive the war. Natural causes. You know, sometimes as a historian, you just flat luck out. I had a fishing buddy whose daughter owned her own medical corporation, has several physicians working for her. and he was interested in my work. But, you know, these drugs that Hitler was taking, some of them hasn't been manufactured since the late 40s, because he was taking handfuls of pills and drugs. And I couldn't interpret them. I took them to a cousin of mine who practiced medicine for 30 years. He couldn't tell me what they were. They had expired. And my fishing buddy said, give it to me. I'll take it to my doctor, and she'll get it translated. And she had some of the junior physicians in her corporation go to the LSU, I think the LSU Medical Library, maybe it was Tulane. And they researched these drugs. And I got that done for free. How much do you think it would cost me if I had to pay the doctors? But the conclusion was he had a vitamin toxicity. He was taking so many vitamins, it would have eventually killed him probably in a few months. He was addicted to amphetamines or speed. And the active ingredient in his eye drops was cocaine.
In his eye drops. Why was he taking eye drops to begin with?
He had some vision problems associated with the assassination attempt of July 20, 1944. They tried to blow him up, and it exacerbated his eye problem. He was beginning to need glasses anyway. And he took up to 19 applications of his eye drops per day. And the active ingredient is cocaine. So this
what will cocaine do for one's eyes? I've never heard of such a thing.
Well, I'm not that kind of doctor, but it's what Dr. Morrell thought would work, and he prescribed it, and Hitler liked it. He upped the dosage. And
well, we're into the weeds here. Let's stay in the weeds. I want to ask you about Hitler's. You said he had a vitamin toxicity. I've never heard of such a thing. You can get a vitamin toxicity.
You can take so many vitamins, it will kill you. Yes, you can.
I mean, I guess it depends on the vitamin. We know vitamin C goes out into the draft, as it were. But there are other things that will stick with you and can pile up.
Yes.
But you said he was taking certain drugs. What were the drugs? Is that what we were talking about?
Those were the main ones. There were others. It was, the amphetamine would have killed you. The vitamin toxicity would have killed you. And the cocaine probably would have killed you, too. It's killed a lot of people. I didn't know before I read that medical journal that you could even take cocaine through your eyes, but you can.
Well, so it was these things that led you into this period. And so your book, of course, is called The Death of Hitler's War Machine. So what is the takeaway? What do most of us not know that you've written about in this book?
Most of them do not know about the brutality in the East and how the Russian terrorism actually increased German resistance and thus increased Soviet casualties. There were about 2 million rapes in Eastern Germany and German territory. There were 103,000 reported cases of venereal disease in Berlin just from that one battle. And how many were raped that didn't get venereal disease? We'll never know. It was incredible. Also, I talk about the Wilhelm Gustloff. I don't know if you've ever heard of that or not.
No.
Greatest maritime disaster in the history of the world. Five times as many people were killed on the Gustloff as were killed on the Titanic.
And what was the Gustloff?
It was a passenger ship, and they were... because of what the Russians were doing, they were trying to get out of East Prussia, Pomerania, get away from the Russian army. And they were the ship was rated for 1,500 passengers. They put 10,000 on it. And it was wall-to-wall people. It was torpedoed 25 miles offshore by a Russian submarine in January 1945.
Was this out of the port of Stettin, or I can't remember where it is? Right up there on the
Stettin or Danzig.
Yeah, Stettin. Okay. So 10,000 people were on the ship to escape
the Russians. Mm-hmm. Where were they headed?
Western Germany, Hamburg, or Denmark's, anywhere to get away from the Russians. The German Navy evacuated more than 2 million people from the eastern provinces, but they were desperate to get away. In fact, they had lines to get on the ship, and occasionally those lines were attacked by Russian fighter bombers. They wouldn't run for cover because they'd lose their place in line. They took their chances with the bullets.
This sounds a little bit like the fall of Saigon, a level of desperation most of us are simply not aware of.
Yes, there was. Matter of fact, I tell a story which I thought was rather interesting. The Germans didn't have shoes, and that was especially a problem with the children. They'd lost their raw materials. The bandages were made out of paper now, and the kids especially didn't have shoes because, you know, you and I could make our shoes last another year if we had to. But kids grow so fast, that won't work. And this young girl, as she was then, her father had been killed in the East, and her mother wanted him to get out of there, but she was barefooted, and the temperature was 0 degrees Fahrenheit. So what she did, she took the little girl and dipped her feet in cow manure and let it harden. And did it again and again and again until this little girl had cow patty shoes. And she walked all the way across East Prussia and Pomerania and half of Brandenburg to reach British lines and never suffered the slightest repercussions to her health.
It's just unimaginable what people went through. The title of your book is The Death of Hitler's War Machine. So you focus mostly, I suppose, on what happened to the army and how Hitler deployed the army. We're going to go to a break. Folks, I'm talking to Samuel Mitchum. Am I saying that right?
Mitchum, yes.
Mitchum. The book is The Death of Hitler's War Machine. This is the Eric Metaxas Show. We will be right back. Don't forget to go to ericmetaxas.com. Please sign up for my newsletter so you can get all these videos sent to you. We'll be right back. When I think back, I learned in high school. It's a wonder I can think at all. And my lack of education. Prescription Dispensing Labs is a national licensed pharmacy specializing in personalized prescription and natural medicine. The pharmacists at PD Labs are credited with formulating unique nasal sprays for the dreaded brain fog and a leader in uncovering new compounds to improve your health. PD Labs is one of the first pharmacies to now offer a telemedicine group trained in prevention medicine and how to restore your health. They have developed signature professional supplements that really work rather than just promotional advertising. PD Labs Pharmacy prides itself on innovation and amazing customer service that show dedication to your health. Today, everyone needs a choice in their health care, and they bring many refreshing options on how to maximize your body's amazing capabilities to bounce back. PD Labs has an extensive network of practitioners nationwide dedicated to true health care, not sick care. Visit their website, pdlabsrx.com, for free health tips, podcasts, and their popular online store. Call 888-909-0110. Ask for Ray and tell them Eric sent you. That's 888-909-0110. Hey there, friends. Eric Metaxas here. Hey there, folks. We're talking about The Death of Hitler's War Machine, a new book by Samuel Mitchum. You live in Monroe, Louisiana.
Right.
I have been duck hunting with Phil Robertson in that neck of the woods. I don't know if you know those folks, but I happen to have been to your part of the world.
Well, we're good friends. We go to church together, and every Sunday we sit by each other.
Well, I'm a big fan of that guy and a privilege to know him. So glad to know you do as well. If you're going to live in Monroe, Louisiana, you ought to know those folks. Well, your book is The Death of Hitler's War Machine, long ways from the world of Monroe, Louisiana. What do you write about in this book? In other words, why would people be interested in reading this book? What is the news?
Well, a military man would especially be interested, military woman. But also it was partially aimed at the civilians to let people know what Germany went through at the end of World War II. And sort of a subplot of that is the fact that the result of terrorism, Stalin deliberately applied a red terror, and it cost him because resistance in the East was fierce at a time when resistance in the West was crumbling. Like the Battle of the Ruhr Pocket was the last major battle on the Western Front. We destroyed Germany's premier industrial area and captured it. And we captured over 300,000 German prisoners. And the total loss to the Americans was 17,000 killed and wounded. That's an incredibly lopsided victory. Had we been employing Stalin's tactics, our losses probably would have approached 300,000.
So the brutality of the Soviets backfired on them because it caused the Germans to fight back. They figured that we've got nothing to lose, whereas in the West, obviously, they thought the Allies will go softer on us, and we may as well not fight that hard.
That's true. Also, I have a little bit different interpretation of the Hitler Youth. In the West, they surrendered quickly again, and in the East, especially the Battle of Berlin, they were surprisingly effective. The Germans were mass producing what they called a Panzerfaust, a shoulder mounted a single shot anti-tank weapon. And the Soviet tanks were going through the streets of Berlin block by block, clearing out resistance. And, you know, boys are fond of exploring, and they knew their way around the sewage systems. And these Hitler Youth types would come in behind the Soviet tanks where the armor is the thinnest, fire their single-shot anti-tank weapon at the thinnest part of the armor, blow up a tank, go down the sewage hole, and repeat the process again and again and again. They destroyed an estimated 700 Russian tanks. That's more than enough to equip, as you know, an entire tank army. Nothing like that happened in the West.
That is amazing. Yeah, obviously, anybody familiar with Berlin at this period knows that it was, it was its own world, really. I mean, you see pictures of Hitler coming out of the bunker to greet some of these boys, basically, who were fighting. It was a strange time.
Well, you know, when you got an anti-tank weapon and it hits, you're firing at a tank, it really doesn't matter if you're a 20-year veteran of the Green Berets or a 14-year-old Hitler Youth. The explosion is going to be just as powerful. And these Hitler Youth types did a lot better as combat soldiers than they're normally given credit for. You're supposed to feel sorry for them, and I do. But nevertheless, they were pretty formidable in Berlin.
It's amazing. I think you suggest in your book that Hitler's mania at this point made him deploy the army differently, that he didn't really he didn't seem to care. He treated these human beings as cannon fodder. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think Adolf Hitler was always on a delicate mental perch. And I think about September 1942, he fell off of it and became increasingly megalomaniac and insane. I think he was insane. I get asked that frequently, was Hitler crazy? And my old answer is always, when? When was, what are you talking about, 1923? No. 1945, absolutely. And I think the turning point was in September 1942, and it was partially drug-induced.
I mean, what drugs was he on that would have tipped him off of his perch, as you put it?
Well, the amphetamines and the cocaine. I think those are the big two.
It's hard. I know your doctorate is not in medicine, but it's hard not to speculate from the point of view of somebody who takes demonology seriously, that he had to have opened himself up to demonic influences. It has to be the case. I don't know what evidence we have, but maybe we'll talk about that in the next segment, unless you've got a brief comment.
Not really. I think he was, I don't think he was the Antichrist, but I think he was in that second row of anti-Christian. I think he was evil. I think there were demonic influences, but I don't address that.
All right. We're gonna go to a break here. We're talking to the author of The Death of Hitler's War Machine. I hope you're intrigued, because I certainly am. We'll be right back. For the sunshine sky, there's a reason. Folks, we're talking to the author, Samuel Mitchum, A.M., not U.M., like Robert. The book is The Death of Hitler's War Machine. And we're talking about, obviously, the last years of the war. So what was it that Hitler was doing at this point? In other words, he didn't seem to be playing the long game. This was all or nothing, at least on the Russian front.
Well, The period of Hitler acting was over. The Allies were acting. Hitler was reacting. Rommel called it, the Desert Fox, that he was in a cloud cuckoo land. And that's pretty accurate. He was just trying to deal with the highest flame, lashing out, totally irrational. Great example of that is Helmut Velding. He was commander of the 56th Panzer Corps, and he came into Hitler's presence in the bunker, and Hitler's first words out of his mouth were, "Velding, I will have you shot." And by the end of their meeting, Hitler had named him commandant of Berlin. And Velding walked out of Hitler's office there and into the main room and said, "I would rather he had me shot." And I think he was only half kidding. That's pretty irrational. I'm going to kill you, and now 15 minutes later, you're in command of the Capitol. That's sort of the way Hitler was. Fagelin was his brother-in-law. He had him shot after he had decorated him with some of the highest decorations in Nazi Germany.
Excuse me, when you say brother-in-law, how was Fagelin his brother-in-law?
He married Eva Braun's sister. And
So became his brother-in-law, brother-in-law-to-be, I guess.
Well, they were, the sisters were, yeah. of course, he was cheating on Hitler's sister, but she nevertheless, I misspoke. They were
Eva Braun's sister.
Cheating on Eva Braun's sister.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess at this point, it does seem that Hitler was not able to think rationally. A rational person would have understood the situation in these last months, but he somehow believed mystically that he would be exonerated, that they could still somehow win. Was there any possibility of that? What was he hoping might happen?
He grasped at straws. During the 7 years war with Frederick the Great, the Russian Tsar died, and Russia pulled out, and it allowed Prussia to survive when it looked as if all was lost. He cited that history, and that actually did happen. Human beings, some of them especially, have an infinite capacity for self-delusion. And Hitler was deluding himself. Any indication that things might change, he grasped it. Franklin Delano Roosevelt died in April of 45, just shortly before Hitler. And Hitler took that as proof that history was going to repeat itself and the Allied alliance was going to collapse. And they obviously didn't.
And who recorded that? I'm just curious. Do you remember who it was that heard him say these things?
Oh, there were many. But Paul Joseph Goebbels wrote extensively in his diary about that, which we have copies of most of it. Some of it was lost. He was an invertebrate writer. He always wrote down everything he thought. Let me say, there were others. Keitel, the field marshal, titular head of the Armed Forces High Command. He wanted to believe it, and he wrote about it as well.
It's just amazing. We've just got a couple of minutes left. I'm enjoying this very much. We're talking to Samuel Mitchum. The book is The Death of Hitler's War Machine. What is the main thing that people who are students of the war would learn from your book that they didn't know? Let's put it that way.
Oh, it really depends on the student. It gives an overview of the German armed forces at the end of the war, whether it was the Western Front, Eastern Front, Italy, Luftwaffe, the German civilians. It covers the waterfront. It's chronological rather than one theme. We haven't even touched on the air war, which was tremendous. In Dresden, you talked about that. The firebomb could be seen for 60 miles, and the asphalt caught on fire. The streets burned, and asphalt burns at 750 degrees Fahrenheit, so it was hotter than that. They created hell on earth. But the Germans had a strangely grim sense of humor about it all. They joked about these things and said, well, if the Allies keep bombing, they're going to have to start bringing their own targets, because all they're doing now is shuffling the rubble. And they said, well, and it's easier to believe in final victory than to run around Berlin without your head.
Yes. Do you ever wonder whether we needed to hit Dresden in that way and kill those civilians? Is that something that we just have to chalk up the way we do the atom bombs? What is your take on that?
I think we didn't have to. We were asked to by Stalin. We cooperated with our allies, and I think we should have found a way not to do that.
Does it ever make you sick that we were in bed with Stalin? It's so strange to me that I don't know what to think of that.
Well, is the enemy of my enemy my friend? Philosophical question that's been asked for centuries. Each individual will have to answer that. I wish we hadn't allied with him or hadn't been necessary. But my takeaway is the big winner of World War II was the Soviet Union and Stalin.
And unfortunately, that is also my takeaway, reluctant takeaway. But Samuel Mitchum, it's been wonderful to meet you and to speak with you. The book is The Death of Hitler's War Machine. Sir, thank you for your work.
Sheltered me from harm.
Hola, Alben.
Hola to you, too.
Quiero invitarte a mi fiesta de cumpleaños.
I agree 100%.
Because I am old.
Okay,
Alben.
Yes, sir.
We've got a lot of fun stuff in this. This is like an entertaining segment we're going to do right now before we go into the substantive hour two.
I just realized that card I got in the mail. I was telling you about this before we went on the air today. You get to a certain age, and then you get advertisements in the mail that are like a little creepy.
You didn't. What'd you do with it?
I hung on. Oh, here it is. Here it is. If you're watching on video, you could see this card. I actually got this from a cemetery, okay? And they said they're having an open house weekend.
Alben. This is what happened with Fun Fact Friday. I got to shut you down.
Okay, shut me down.
And I got to explain to the people, Alben is not joking. It's funny, But this is 100% true. You got to tell people, this is real. You're not making this up, man.
Yeah.
Not a joke.
They send it to the Sadar family or current resident, okay? Because
in case you already died while that was in the mail.
To another cemetery. It's an open house weekend where you can actually check out their mausoleums, their traditional cemetery, the crematorium, all these options.
Wait a minute. This is not a joke. Yeah. But you make it sound like you're goofing
but you get
around.
To a certain age
this is
and
real.
You're open, you're fair game.
Okay. It's right? called Gate of Heaven Cemetery Open House Weekend.
Yeah.
Only the dead need apply.
That's right.
But if you're living and you want to make plans for dead people, you can go there. There's an open house. We don't want to give these dates, but it says this is not a joke.
No.
This is not a joke. It seems like a joke. It says crypt and grave discounts.
Yeah.
On open house dates only,
right.
Exclamation point.
50 cents off, right?
And you're like, these sons of guns, I got there one day late, and I got to pay full price for the crypt. Man, you're ripping me off.
Okay.
When I'm dead, I'm going to haunt you bad.
Yeah.
Okay, so it says, begin your pre-planning arrangements today. Many choices are available. Mausoleum crypts. Yep. Interior and exterior.
You can check them out inside.
Traditional cemetery plots, double and triple depth. Oh, the savings.
I'm going to go four times deep this time. Yeah.
Cremation options available. Family plots.
Fun for the whole family this weekend, folks.
I mean, but this is in Hawthorne, New York.
Okay.
GateofHeavenNewYork.com.
Well, at least it's a gate to heaven, right? It could have been another kind
of gate. That's pretty presumptuous of them.
That's right.
It could be a gate to purgatory because it's a Catholic cemetery. Do you ever think about that?
All right, Alvin,
we got to get serious. I mean, now we're not making that up, but it's hilarious. Okay, I got to read another letter. I find this funny. Dear Mr. Metaxas, I appreciate listening to your videos, podcast while working around the house. But yesterday, I listened to your interview with Dr. Simone Gold while milking a cow. This woman makes it seem like it's just something that just happened. I can't explain it.
No.
Obviously, we have a lot of dairy farmers in our listenership.
Yeah.
And the cow's named Molly, and Tess from Alberta, Canada writes, I'm not sure what Molly thought of it. I forgot to ask, but it probably made her day. Keep fighting the good fight of faith. God bless you. Sincerely, Tess, a young adult from Alberta, Canada.
Wow, thank you.
First of all, as a young adult,
let
me just say thank you for listening to this program because I was once a young adult and I didn't listen to programs like this. And so we really appreciate it.
Okay.
Alvin, we've got a lot more to talk about.
Father's Day weekend coming up, so you got to go to salemnow.com and check out The Streets Were My Father. You got to check that out. CSI, you got to give today. CSI, free a slave for $250 at CSI.
We're not making this up, ladies and gentlemen. This is all true.
That's right.
CSI, you go to MetaxasTalk.com. If you want to do something amazing, and I urge you to get your kids involved to make them understand that there's evil in the world, but there is good, God's good in the world, and that we can do something to fight the evil. And we can do something very specifically in this case. Go to CSI. At MetaxasTalk.com. It's an astonishing opportunity that we have to fight evil. We don't just have to complain about it. We can actually do something about it. I don't care.